For an overview of recent apocalyptic fiction, we turn to Justin Taylor, editor of an anthology called simply The Apocalypse Reader, 34 Doomsday Scenarios. Taylor points out that writers have been making up stories about the end of the world for a long time.
Almost from the beginning of time, people were convinced that they were on the cusp of the end of time. And I think that maybe there's something really fundamental in that fact, something about the sort of absurdity and also, you know, beauty of being here at all. You know, the fact that any of us exist and live is just sort of so phenomenal. And it just immediately occurs to us, you know, in the most general abstract sense, we probably shouldn't be, and maybe soon enough we won't. Those thoughts are sort of conjoined.
Well, and everybody, of course, knows that there is life and there is death. And though it's difficult for any of us to think about our own, we are willing enough, I guess, to think about the end of all.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's something comforting about it, right? There's this almost an idea of unity, I think, in this sort of fantasy that you'll be part of the group that witnessed and, you know, not lived through, but, you know, you were there when the world ended as, you know, not you died and everyone else got to go on, but we all went out together. There's a certain camaraderie in that.
There's a story called Gigantic. Introduce it for us, will you?
So Steve Aylett is a British writer. His work really transcends just about any genre. So in this story from Steve's collection called Toxicology, a guy named Professor Skychum, basically he's discovered this secret about the universe, which is that there's this problem with guilt, that it's accreting sort of in the interstices of the time-space continuum. And all human guilt from basically every, you know, bad thing that humans have ever done to each other is creating this physical stuff. And Skychum has basically realized that it's reaching a critical mass.
Over the White House, a screeching noise erupted. The central eye of a multidimensional airship was opening. For the space of two heartbeats, everything stopped. Then a tiny tear dropped out of the eye, splashing on the White House roof. And then another. These were corpses, these two. Human corpses. Followed by more in a shower which grew heavier by the moment. And then the eye began gushing. 68 forgotten pensioners buried in a mass grave in 1995 were dumped over the Chicago Social Services. Hundreds of blacks murdered in police cells hit the roof of Scotland Yard. Thousands of slaughtered East Timorese were dumped over the assembly buildings in Jakarta. Berlin was almost instantly clotted, its streets packed wall to wall with victims. Beijing was swamped with tank fodder and girl babies. No longer preserved by denial, they started to sludge. Carpet-bombing gore splattered the suburbs, followed by human slurry tumbling down the streets like lava. Cheap human fallout from pain ignored and war extended for profit. The first wave. So far, only 60 years worth.
That's an image that's not likely to leave soon. It's interesting how many of the writers seem to look at the apocalypse, I guess, as a way to tell us who we are and where we are and what we're doing. I was thinking back about Nathaniel Hawthorne. I can't remember the name of the story that he wrote that you included.
It's called Earth's Holocaust. It's sort of a fable. This figure, very much like Hawthorne himself, is watching this movement and these people, as he says, the wide world had become so overburdened with an accumulation of worn-out trumpery that the inhabitants determined to rid themselves of it by a general bonfire. So people are just, they're tired of their stuff and the old ways and the world. And so they build this bonfire and they start throwing things into it, you know, just old junk that they don't need anymore. And then the bonfire gets a little bit bigger and then they decide that they're going to get rid of coats of arms. We don't need these anymore. You know, this is the old way and all men are better than this and so on. So they start burning coats of arms, tobacco, marriage licenses, money, tax documents. The bonfire keeps getting bigger and they keep getting more aggressive.
See what heaps of books and pamphlets, cried a fellow who did not seem to be a lover of literature. That's just the thing, said a modern philosopher. Now we shall get rid of the weight of dead man's thought. which has hitherto pressed so heavily on the living intellect. Into the fire with them. Now you are enlightening the world indeed.
I think it's fascinating to look back at a century ago or more and see that people are concerned about some of the same things that we are. There are some of the authors who have had some fun. Neil Gaiman, for instance, he has a story, I think it's called When We Went to See the End of the World. It's told by an 11-year-old girl.
Yeah, that story is a riot. Neil posits that the end of the world is, it's a place for him, almost like a cheesy amusement park. So it's narrated by Donnie Morningside, age 11 and a quarter, whose parents are taking the whole family on this trip to go spend the day at the end of the world and have a picnic there.
This is what it looks like at the end of the world, which is the best place in the world. There is a hole in the ground, which looks like a very wide, big hole, and pretty people holding sticks and scimitars that burn come up out of it. They have long golden hair. They look like princesses, only fierce. Some of them have wings and some of them doesn't. And there's a big hole in the sky, too, and things are coming down from it, like the cat-heady man, and the snakes made out of stuff that looks like glitter gel, like I put it on my hair at Hallowmorn, and I saw something that looked like a big gold buzzyfly coming down from the sky. There were very many of them, as many as stars. They don't move. They just hang there, not doing anything. I asked Daddy why they weren't moving, and he said that they were moving, just very slowly, but I don't think so. We set up at a picnic table. What's after the end of the world? I said to my dad. Nothing, he said. Nothing at all. That's why it's called the end. Then Daisy was sick over Daddy's shoes, and we cleaned it up.
It's funny, isn't it, to think of them taking a day trip to see the end of the world. There are so many themes that sort of come back. Different people treat them different ways. There is a story called These Zombies Are Not a Metaphor, which anybody who has read Richard Matheson's book or, I suppose, seen the movie, I Am Legend, would understand.
Well, the premise of Jeff's story is that there's this full-scale zombie outbreak, you know, in this sort of classic George Romero sense, and the narrator and his small group of friends are barricaded in their house trying to stage their last stand. But all the narrator's friends are so preoccupied with the zombie as metaphor to the point where they can't recognize the physical, you know, absolutely non-metaphoric zombie that's physically trying to break the door down.
When the full-scale zombie outbreak finally occurred, I was the only one prepared. I don't mean with supplies and weapons and secure shelter, but more importantly, I had the proper mental fortification. Baxter said to me, "These zombies are a metaphorical scourge upon the earth. They represent all that is evil in humankind." Then he went outside, got bitten, and turned into one of them. I held a meeting with the rest of my housemates. "Let's be very clear," I said. "These zombies are not a metaphorical scourge upon the earth. These zombies are an actual scourge upon the earth." I pointed out the window. We could see the hordes of walking dead in the streets, tearing into the flesh of the living. "These zombies do not represent all that is evil in humankind. They do not represent anything except zombies." "Yes, yes," Manny and Janine nodded at me, blank affirmative stares, eager for leadership in the uncertainty of the world's end. A half-decayed, blood-smeared face smashed itself up against my metal-barred, bulletproof glass window. I flipped a switch and activated the electric current. "Not an allegory, an analogy, or an illusion," I said. "This is not the foreshadowing of the downfall of man. This is the downfall itself."
Wow. What is it that is so attractive about the apocalypse to writers?
Well, I think, you know, that in a certain sense that, you know, all writing, all attempts to create a narrative, they're attempts at mastery, really. You know, you're trying to establish yourself as a speaking voice and, you know, assert some sort of control over a situation, you know, real or imagined. Even just, you know, stake out a little space of your own, you know, in the world. And so the apocalypse, you know, it's this giant signal moment, and it has such gravity, and you can really project almost anything you want onto it or fantasize anything you like about it, and that just makes it so ripe. But I think, as you know, as a writer, as an artist, you know that's sort of the biggest way you can bomb out, because it's beyond everybody, so of course it's beyond you. But at the same time, that makes you want to go you know, right for it.
Dustin Taylor is the editor of The Apocalypse Reader, a collection of 34 short stories about the end of the world. Our selections were read by Peter Sobel, Ariella Borod, Norman Gilliland, and Doug Gordon.